This episode of The Trail Went Cold is brought to you by our sponsor, Wink, whom we would like to thank for being such a great supporter of our show. Wink is offering our audience members who are over 21 and live in the U.S. a $20 credit plus free shipping on their first order of 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Wink. So please visit trywink.com/cold. That's trywink.com/cold. Thank you and enjoy the show. April 16th, 1987. Union City, Tennessee. 4-year-old Marlena Childress vanishes from her front yard after her mother, Pamela Bailey, claims she saw a red car driving away from their house. 2 months later, Pam claims she accidentally killed Marlena and tossed her body into a river. Pam soon recants her confession and claims it was coerced, and with no other evidence to implicate her, she is not indicted for her daughter's disappearance. Over the next several years, there would be a number of twists and turns, including eyewitness sightings to suggest Marlena was still alive, and Pamela Bailey's involvement in another horrific crime, but Marlena is never found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today I'll be chronicling a pretty controversial missing children's case, the 1987 disappearance of 4-year-old Marlena Childress. Yes, this is a case which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, but it's pretty unique in that the show only aired the segment once, and never did so again, apparently at the request of the family. I am pretty certain that I saw this segment on TV when it originally aired in September of 1990, but I recently rewatched it when it was uploaded to YouTube a few months ago. And no, before anybody asks, the segment has since been taken down, so it's no longer available for viewing. What's particularly bizarre about this story is that Marlena's mother, Pamela Bailey, would confess to accidentally killing her daughter, but then recant her confession, and there have been eyewitness sightings of Marlena to support the idea that she was still alive somewhere after she went missing. I know that when I watched the Unsolved Mystery segment again, I went back and forth on this case, and soon fell down a massive rabbit hole after doing further research. So of course, I instantly decided that I had to do a podcast episode, and I believe this will be the most complete account of this complex case you will find. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is finally on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved disappearance of Marlena Childress. Our story begins in Union City, Tennessee in 1987. Our central figure is 4-year-old Marlena Childress, who lives with her 22-year-old mother, Pamela Bailey. Pam is divorced from Marlena's father, Kevin Childress, and is currently married to another man, Johnny Bailey, and the couple also have a 4-month-old infant son named Damon. On April 16th, Johnny's 7-year-old son from a previous marriage, Jerry Bailey, was visiting their home until he was picked up shortly before 3 p.m. by Jerry's mother, Mona Watts. At around 3:30, Pam claimed that Marlena was playing outside alone in the front yard while she was in the house. Pam suddenly heard the squeal of some skidding car tires, and when she glanced outside the window, she saw a 2-door red car speeding away. Even though Pam never caught a glimpse of the driver, she noticed that the vehicle had license plates from McCracken County, Kentucky. Shortly thereafter, Pam went outside to check on her daughter, but was surprised to discover that Marlena was gone. After searching the neighborhood and failing to find her, Pam contacted the police at around 4:15 to report Marlena missing. A massive search of the area was eventually organized by law enforcement and thousands of volunteers, but they failed to turn up any trace of Marlena. The most promising lead was the red car Pam claimed she had seen driving away from her house. At around 2 that afternoon, Pam had dropped off Marlena and her stepbrother Jerry at a grocery store 2 blocks away in order to purchase candy. Jerry told police that before they went back home, he saw Marlena briefly speaking with a man next to a red car outside the store, though he didn't hear the conversation. Other witnesses from the store, including the owner, also witnessed this and described the man as looking like he might belong to a motorcycle gang. The witness's description of the vehicle matched the description of the red car Pam had seen, and it also had plates from McCracken County. However, this lead turned out to be a dead end, as the man seen outside the store was eventually tracked down and ruled out as a suspect. Marlena's biological father, Kevin Childress, lived in Union City, but he was cleared of any involvement, as was her stepfather, Johnny Bailey, who was at work that afternoon. During this time period, Pam went on the local news to make a public plea for her daughter's safe return, but the ordeal took a considerable toll on her. A month and a half after Marlena went missing, Pam checked herself into a hospital for exhaustion. She was soon released from the hospital, but 9 days later, on June the 8th, there was a shocking revelation. Pam confessed that she was responsible for Marlena's disappearance. The confession was made to Stan Kavnis, a private investigator who had been hired by Pam's family to work on the case. According to Pam, she was trying to attend to her infant son Damon, and Marlena was misbehaving and running in and out of the house. In the heat of the moment, Pam turned around and slapped Marlena so hard that she fell over and accidentally hit her head on a table, causing her death. Pam subsequently placed Marlena's body in her pickup truck and drove towards the nearby town of Martin. Along the way, she stopped at a payphone to contact a 65-year-old family friend who lived in Martin named P.L. Summers in order to request his assistance. Summers then met Pam at a bridge on Campground Road, and they both proceeded to dispose of Marlena's body by throwing her into the North Fork of the Obion River. This entire confession was recorded by Stan Kavnis, who subsequently turned it over to the police. Pam would be arrested and charged with second-degree murder and was placed in a mental health institution for a court-ordered psychological evaluation. Hundreds of people performed a massive search of the Obion River for 5 straight days, but they failed to turn up any trace of Marlena's body. Police questioned P.L. Summers, the man whom Pam had named as her accomplice, but he denied any involvement. He said he did know Pam personally, but claimed to have not actually seen her for 2 years. Following the announcement of Pam's confession, many of her neighbors gave statements to the media with conflicting accounts. Some of them believed Pam was a good mother and did not suspect any issues in her family, while others recalled having seen bruises on Marlena's body and wondered if abuse might have been taking place. However, within 2 weeks of her arrest, Pam surprised everyone by recanting her confession. Pam claimed she was feeling great emotional strain and was under the heavy influence of medication for depression following her hospital stay, and that Stan Kavnis took advantage of this in order to coerce a confession out of her. According to Pam, Kavnis told her that everyone believed she was guilty. He said a witness had seen her throw Marlena's body into the river, and there was also physical evidence which implicated her. Kavnis told Pam she would go to the electric chair if she did not confess to what she had done, and advised her to say that Marlena's death was an accident, so people wouldn't think she was a cold-blooded murderer. Since Pam was emotionally spent by this point, she went along with what Kavnis said and told him what he wanted to hear, but claimed that nothing she said was true. While Kavnis denied these allegations and said that Pam spoke to him voluntarily because she felt guilt and remorse over what she had done. In response, Kavnis decided to hold a press conference in which he played a 5-minute excerpt from Pam's tape-recorded confession and expressed his belief that she was being truthful about everything she said. Pam then raised some more eyebrows by changing her story again. This time, Instead of pointing the finger at P.L. Summers and implicating him as her accomplice, she now said he was the sole perpetrator. Pam claimed that Summers had sexually abused her as a child, and that a lot of this abuse took place at the same bridge where she confessed to tossing Marlena's body into the river. On the afternoon of April 16th, Summers showed up at Pam's home to make sexual advances on her again, but when she resisted them, Summers responded by abducting Marlena. Pam said she never told anybody about this earlier because Summers had threatened the lives of herself and her husband. Once again, Summers denied all these allegations, and since he seemed to have a credible alibi on the day Marlena went missing, police became satisfied that he wasn't involved. But it's worth mentioning that in September of 1987, Summers would be charged with aggravated sexual battery for allegedly fondling a 9-year-old boy, though investigators maintained that this incident had no connection to Marlena's case. Pam's father, LaWade Strickland, would also point towards another potential lead, as neighbors had recalled seeing a blue car near Pam's home around the time Marlena disappeared. Investigators were certain that the blue car belonged to Johnny Bailey's ex-wife, Mona Watts, who had stopped by the house to pick up her son shortly before 3 p.m. that day, but LaWade said that at least one witness had recalled seeing a second blue car in the neighborhood sometime between 3:15 and 3:30 after Mona already left. Regardless, the lead never went anywhere, and after undergoing her psychological evaluation, Pam was deemed mentally fit to stand trial. The district attorney eventually agreed to reduce the charge against her from second-degree murder to voluntary manslaughter, which only would have carried a prison sentence of 2 to 10 years. The case went to a grand jury, but since Marlena's body could not be found, and the only evidence against Pam was her questionable confession, they ultimately decided not to indict her. Pam continued to maintain her innocence, and decided to escape the spotlight by moving back to her original hometown of Mayfield, Kentucky. The investigation would now focus on eyewitness sightings, which seemed to suggest that Marlena might still be alive. In November of 1988, Social Services received a report about child neglect, which was supposedly taking place at a home in Anniston, Alabama. A couple lived there with 10 children, and believe it or not, their last name was Childress, even though they were of no relation to Marlena's family. A social worker went to visit the home and spoke to a young girl who apparently told her that her name was Marlena Childress. The name sounded familiar, and the social worker later realized that she had seen Marlena Childress's missing poster and that the girl she spoke to bore a resemblance to her. The authorities were notified, but by the time they arrived at the Childress home, the entire family was gone. The Childresses were described as having a gypsy-like existence, as they would move around from state to state and live off governmental assistance checks, and it would turn out that the father, Oliver Childress, had open arrest warrants on him. Neighbors were shown Marlena's photograph, and they identified her as the same child they'd seen living at the residence, though they claimed she went by the name Crystal. They believed the family was much more protective of Crystal than the other children, and that they rarely let her out of the house. The most convincing piece of evidence that Crystal might be Marlena is that she was described as having silver-capped teeth, which Marlena also had at the time she went missing. 6 months after they left, the Childress family were finally tracked down in Florida, but Marlena was not with them, and there was a strange discrepancy with the girl known as Crystal. According to Oliver Childress, Crystal must have been the girl the social worker spoke to and confused her with Marlena. It would turn out that while 9 of the 10 children were biological members of the family, Crystal was not. Oliver claimed that Crystal's mother was from Lubbock, Texas, and had given her to him 2 years ago. He even produced a note which read, "I'm giving her to Oliver Childress." Well, police were unable to authenticate the note or verify this story, but Oliver would be arrested for sexually abusing 2 of his children. All the kids would be placed in foster care, but as far as I can tell, no evidence was ever found to conclusively prove that Marlena had ever been with this family. There was another potential sighting of Marlena in Lenoir City, Tennessee, in September of 1989. This time, a woman named Amy Spoon was shopping with her children at a department store when they started playing with a young girl. Amy briefly spoke to the girl until another woman whom she assumed was her mother called her over. This woman looked angry, and the girl seemed reluctant to go to her. Shortly thereafter, Amy saw a missing persons flyer with Marlena's photograph, and recognized her as the girl from the department store. Anyway, Marlena's case wound up being featured on Unsolved Mysteries on an episode which aired on September 5th, 1990. It's worth mentioning that this was not a new episode, as the show would sometimes film new segments and insert them into reruns which aired during the summer and early fall, so Marlena's story was featured alongside segments that had already aired before. This segment looked into Amy Spoon's sighting of Marlena from Lenore City, but the majority of its focus was placed on a sighting which took place on April 22, 1987, only 6 days after Marlena went missing. It took place 100 miles away from Union City at an establishment in Memphis called Jean's Hair Salon. Gail Reich and Janice Wells, a pair of hairdressers working that day, claimed that a young girl matching Marlena's description walked into the salon. She was accompanied by a boy who appeared to be around 6 years old and two women, a younger one in her 20s or 30s, and an elderly lady who looked like she was in her 50s or 60s. Anyway, while Gail was giving the girl a haircut, she started crying out, "I want my mummy, I want to go home." The younger woman barely reacted to the girl's crying and did not attempt to console her, which made Gail suspect that she might not actually be her mother. The older woman soon spoke out and said, "Be a good girl, Marlena, and we'll take you to the movies." The group then left in a vehicle which was described as having Maryland plates. Later that same day, Gail went out on her break and stopped by a convenience store where she noticed a newspaper which was running a story about Marlena Childress's disappearance and had her photo on the front page. Gail instantly recognized her as the girl she had seen at the salon, and when Janice Wells was shown the photo, she concurred. Marlena's maternal grandfather, Lloyd Strickland, would eventually travel to Memphis to perform his own independent investigation into the sighting. He came to believe that the younger woman seen in the salon might have been a local waitress who had allegedly left town the morning after Marlena went missing and returned a few days later. Lloyd decided to take Gail and Janice to the waitress's restaurant while she was working, and they both identified her as the woman from the salon. Lloyd then showed the two hairdressers a photo lineup featuring six young boys. Gail and Janice both picked out a photo of a boy whom they recognized as the boy from the salon before Lloyd revealed this was the waitress's son. After Lloyd shared this information with the police, they questioned the waitress, who denied having any knowledge of Marlena Childress. Since she passed a polygraph, and police found no evidence to implicate her, they came to believe the waitress was probably not involved. But shortly after this questioning took place, Gail and Janice claimed they started receiving threatening phone calls at the salon from an anonymous female caller. Anyway, the Unsolved Mystery segment brought in over 200 tips from viewers, but nothing that brought them any closer to a resolution. This would turn out to be the only time the segment ever aired on the show, as due to the controversial nature of the case, Marlena's family apparently asked that it not be shown again. And in 2002, there would be a disturbing postscript to this story. By this point, Pam Bailey was still living in Mayfield, Kentucky, and had since had another son named Casey, who was now 12 years old. On the evening of April 22nd, Pam told Casey that she was taking him somewhere for a quote-unquote surprise. As they were driving, Pam gave Casey a handkerchief and told him to blindfold himself until they arrived. They wound up stopping at a rural cemetery. With their son still blindfolded, Pam led him to a cemetery marker with the word son inscribed on it. She asked Casey to sit down before she suddenly pulled out a knife and attacked him, stabbing Casey 3 times in the neck and shoulder. Thankfully, Casey managed to kick his mother away and escape before running to a nearby house to seek help. After he recovered from the attack, Casey was released to the custody of his father. Pam was quickly arrested and charged with attempted murder, but she claimed to have blacked out and had no memory of stabbing her son. She ultimately wound up pleading no contest to second-degree assault and received a 10-year prison sentence. Oddly, even though they ended up filing for divorce, Pam's ex-husband, Johnny Bailey, publicly came to her defense and campaigned for her release in 2004. Even though Pam had stabbed their son, Johnny claimed that Casey was no longer fearful of her and that he would have no problem having his ex-wife around his children again. Pam served her time and has since been released, but her current whereabouts are unknown. This incident seemed to reaffirm the police's belief that Pam was responsible for Marlena's disappearance, as her attack on Casey happened to take place only 6 days after the 15-year anniversary. However, even though the investigation was reopened, no new evidence could be uncovered to implicate Pam, and after more than 30 years, Marlena's whereabouts continue to remain unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, it's that time again. I need to take a break in order to pour myself a glass of wine and propose a toast to our sponsor, Wink. Wink is targeting a new generation of wine drinkers who want to do away with the pretense and simply enjoy reasonably priced great wine. Wink custom tailors wines to the taste of the individual consumer and delivers 3 bottles of wine each month to your doorstep for $39 plus free shipping. When you visit Wink and take their 20-second palate profile quiz, you'll get instant wine recommendations based on your unique profile. The price point for most wines is $13, so by signing up with Wink, you are getting your first bottle for free. Wink is offering our audience members who are 21 and live in the U.S. a $20 credit plus free shipping on your first order of 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Wink. Your wine delivery will be branded Wink. Wink is the wine club associated with Wink. Anyway, for our toast this time around, I've got myself a 2017 bottle of Restless Earth Petite Syrah, a handcrafted blend from the high-elevation Santa Barbara Highlands Vineyard in California, which is inky black and deeply brooding. This high-elevation location provides a lot of UV intensity, while a 30 to 40 degree daily temperature swing helps keep the wine grapes protected from the sun's intensity. This bold, rustic blend has tasting notes of black currant, clove, cocoa, and plum, and goes really well with ribs and chocolate cake. They recommend popping open this wine 20 minutes before serving, so of course, I did so right before the start of this episode. Anyway, to receive a $20 credit and free shipping on 4 bottles of wine just like this one on your first order, go to trywink.com/cold. That's trywink.com/cold. trywinc.com/cold. So let's raise our glasses high, and here's a toast to Wink. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of our show. Like I mentioned in the intro, prior to recently watching the Unsolved Mystery segment on YouTube, the only time I'd seen it was when it originally aired 28 years ago, and I hadn't really thought about this case since then. So it's been fascinating to dive into the rabbit hole and follow all the twists and turns, and while putting this episode together, I changed my mind about it multiple times. There definitely is good reason to be suspicious of Pam Bailey and believe that she was responsible for her daughter's disappearance. Given that there was no other evidence to implicate her, it would be easy to believe that her confession to killing Marlena was false, but when you learn that she stabbed another one of her children 15 years later, it's a lot harder to accept that she's an innocent victim. I mean, one of the original obstacles for believing that Pam killed Marlena is that there didn't seem to be any apparent motive for that crime, but as far as I can tell, there wasn't any discernible motive for her to stab her son Casey either. All she ever said was that she blacked out and could not even remember it. I don't know if that's actually true, but if it is, who's to say a similar situation couldn't have occurred with Marlena? But if she was completely innocent, could the strain of losing one child and being falsely accused have caused Pam to snap? Given that her attack on Casey took place only a few days after the 15th anniversary of Marlena's disappearance, it's not hard to believe there might be a connection. And yet, as tempting as it may be to throw Pam to the wolves, it's quite remarkable how much support she has still received. How many other cases will you find where a mother will go to prison for stabbing her own son, and the child's father will publicly campaign for her early release? I don't know what it is, but it seems like even though Pam has harmed one child and is suspected of harming another, some people refuse to believe she's a bad person. But I have to admit, even after learning about what she did to her son, I still had to question if Pam really was responsible for what happened to Marlena. Because on the surface, it seemed like there was credible evidence to suggest Marlena was still alive after she was reported missing. The primary piece of evidence supporting Pam's innocence was the sighting of the child resembling Marlena at the hair salon in Memphis 6 days after she vanished. Now, I know I must sound like a broken record since I've said this so many times on the podcast, but it's worth reiterating. Eyewitness sightings and missing persons cases can be notoriously unreliable. Whenever a missing persons case gets extensive coverage in the media, which Marlena certainly did, it's inevitable that witnesses will come forward to state they saw the victim somewhere, but more often than not, it turns out they were mistaken, and they only saw someone else who resembled the missing individual. However, some of the details provided by the two hairdressers in Memphis made me genuinely consider the possibility that the girl they saw might actually have been Marlena. For starters, one of the women the girl was with actually referred to her as Marlena, which is not an overly common name. There's also the fact that this girl kept crying and saying, "I want my mummy." The younger woman she was with did not even react to this, so why would this girl be asking for her mother if she was standing right there? Another reason I thought this sighting was more convincing than most is because the hairdresser saw Marlena's photo in the newspaper a very short time after the girl was in the salon. This is the thing with mistaken eyewitness sightings. A lot of the time, these witnesses will see a missing poster or a photo of the victim in the papers and realize, "Hey, I saw this person." But this is days or weeks after the fact. Since all that time has passed, their memory may not be reliable. But when Gail Reich saw Marlena's photo, it was only about a few hours after she gave the girl a haircut, so her memory of the incident still would have been fresh. If the sighting was accurate, and Marlena was still alive in Memphis on April 22nd, then this meant Pam couldn't have killed her and thrown her body into the Obion River, so her confession had to be false. I started to ponder the possibility that perhaps Pam sold or gave Marlena away to this other woman, as there are unconfirmed reports that she once said she sold Marlena to pay off a drug debt. Pam could have eventually become so racked with guilt over the whole thing that she fabricated a story about killing her, even though that's not what actually happened. This hair salon sighting was the focal point of the Unsolved Mystery segment, and I have to admit that it initially left me completely on the fence in regards to Pam's guilt or innocence, but I still felt there was something off about how this part of the story was presented on the show. For one thing, it wasn't made clear if the two hairdressers immediately reported this sighting to the police. The way the segment presented things, Marlena's grandfather, Lloyd Strickland, was investigating this lead single-handedly and only went to the police after he uncovered a promising suspect. This always seemed pretty odd to me, because Lloyd Strickland was not a professional private investigator. He was a guy who ran a shoe repair business, but I can see why he'd want to take the reins, since the last private investigator he hired tape-recorded his daughter confessing to murder. But the one key part of the story which seemed to be missing from the Unsolved Mystery segment is how Lloyd tracked down the waitress in Memphis. The story goes that Lloyd brought the two hairdressers into her restaurant, and they identified her as the woman they saw in the salon, and they also correctly identified the waitress's son as the boy they saw. Lloyd also claimed he had learned this woman left town the morning after Marlena's disappearance and returned a few days later, which made her seem like a very promising suspect. That's all well and good, but it's still not clear to me how Lloyd got from point A to point B, and what made him suspect this waitress was the same woman from the hair salon in the first place. When you consider the fact that police questioned her and came to the conclusion that she probably wasn't involved in Marlena's disappearance, something just didn't feel right to me. Well, I finally got my answer when I went to newspapers.com and uncovered articles from the April 25th, 1987 editions of the Tennessean and the Jackson Sun, which both state that the two women and the girl seen at the hair salon were actually tracked down, and the girl was ruled out as being Marlena. The story goes that the group was pulled over by the police in Mississippi, who discovered that the girl's name was actually Marlene, not Marlena, meaning that the hairdressers may have misheard the older woman when she referred to the girl by name. Before they were even found, a key detail which convinced police this girl might not be Marlena was that Marlena had silver-capped teeth when she went missing, but no one from the hair salon recalled seeing capped teeth on the girl. So it seems to me that this sighting of Marlena may have already been investigated and debunked by police long before the Unsolved Mystery segment aired, but Lloyd Strickland was taking it upon himself to keep this lead alive. But that's not all. I also uncovered a very interesting article from the September 6, 1990 edition of the Paducah Sun, published the day after the Unsolved Mystery segment aired. Believe it or not, Pam Bailey herself was quoted as saying that the whole segment about the hair salon should have been omitted because two detectives hired by the family had already checked it out, and it wasn't Marlena. So yes, even though this lead seemed to be the biggest piece of evidence supporting her innocence, Pam did not believe it was credible, and it was quite a surprise to hear her say that not only had the police ruled it out, but two detectives hired by her own family. Pam also stated that the sighting of Marlena with the family who traveled from Alabama to Florida would ultimately point police towards her daughter, and LeWade expressed his disappointment in the article that this lead wasn't even mentioned on Unsolved Mysteries. But we'll talk more about that momentarily. Another thing which seemed off about the Memphis sighting is that in those articles I mentioned from 1987, there's no mention of a young boy being in the hair salon, only two women with a girl. It's possible they neglected to mention the boy, since his presence wasn't really relevant to the case, but it seems like the main reason LeWade was convinced the waitress he tracked down was the woman from the salon is because the two hairdressers identified her son as the boy they saw. But even if they're correct, it really doesn't matter that much if the girl they were with was already ruled out as being Marlena. It really does seem like LeWade was grasping at straws here. I'm not saying that LeWade was trying to cover for his daughter and purposely lead the investigation in the wrong direction, but it would definitely be in his best interest to pursue a lead which pointed to his granddaughter still being alive and his daughter not being a murderer. I know the hairdressers claim they started receiving threatening anonymous phone calls from a woman shortly after the waitress was questioned, but I don't think it's definitive proof that she was involved in Marlena's disappearance. Think about it. If this waitress was completely innocent, she just got accused by police of being involved in a child abduction. Now, I'm not advocating for anonymous threatening phone calls, but if she figured out that this was the result of these hairdressers pointing the finger at her, I can see how she might have felt compelled to take out her anger on them. So when you look at this situation as a whole, I think the significance of the hair salon sighting has been blown way out of proportion, and this is probably just another tragic case of eyewitnesses mistaking a girl they saw for a missing child. In fact, it would not surprise me if this was one of the reasons the Unsolved Mysteries segment only aired on television once, as it put heavy emphasis on a lead which had seemingly been ruled out by law enforcement only days after it occurred. When you eliminate this sighting, then this decreases the chances of Marlena still being alive after April 16, 1987, and weakens the case for Pam's innocence. It's interesting how there are certain aspects of this case which seem to lean away from Pam being responsible, but then come apart if you look hard enough. For example, Pam's original story is that she saw a red car speeding away from her house around the time Marlena went missing, which is supposed to give off the impression that someone abducted her. On the surface, the most convincing detail of Pam's account is that she described the vehicle as having license plates from McCracken County, Kentucky. As you recall, Marlena's stepbrother and other witnesses from a nearby grocery store described seeing a red car with McCracken County license plates and claimed that Marlena had been speaking with a man standing outside this vehicle. Based on this, it's very easy to believe Pam's story and assume that this man set his eyes on Marlena, followed her home, and once he noticed she was playing alone in her front yard, he used this opportunity to abduct her and flee the area. But the problem is that police were able to track down this man relatively quickly and rule him out as a suspect. This detail is often overlooked in some accounts of this case, but you can find confirmation in the April 22, 1987 edition of the Jackson Sun. So it seems like this entire lead was nothing more than a red herring, and there are two possible explanations. A. If Pam is innocent, then she really did see the red car pass by her house, but it either wasn't this man's car, or the driver did not actually abduct Marlena. Or B. If Pam is guilty, then she could have seen this car when she took Marlena and Jerry to the store that afternoon, and remembered the details about it when she fabricated her cover story. Perhaps she felt more people would believe the story if other witnesses from the store could corroborate seeing the red car in the area. I know that after Pam was arrested, LeWade Strickland began pointing the investigation towards an alleged sighting of a blue car in the neighborhood that afternoon. While the authorities seemed convinced that it belonged to Mona Watts, who was picking up her son at that time, Lloyd seemed to think there was another blue car in the area. Personally, I think he was probably just grasping at straws again in order to help clear his daughter. But to be fair, there have been other leads in this case. The Unsolved Mysteries segment presented another eyewitness sighting from Amy Spoon, who claimed she saw a girl resembling Marlena in a department store in 1989. But unlike the hair salon sighting, there were no significant details which pointed to the girl actually being Marlena, so for all we know, Amy Spoon could have simply seen another young girl and read too much into the uncomfortable interaction between the girl and the woman she was with. Since this particular girl wasn't tracked down and ruled out, I can't say with 100% certainty that she wasn't Marlena, but in all likelihood, it was probably another mistaken sighting. However, perhaps the most intriguing lead were the alleged sightings of Marlena living with a family of 10 children in Alabama before they suddenly took off and were found in Florida months later. Like I just mentioned, LaWade Strickland was disappointed that they didn't include this info in the Unsolved Mysteries segment. Even if Marlena wasn't connected to this family, this is still a pretty bizarre side story. As you recall, the family's last name also happened to be Childress, and while 9 of the 10 children belonged to the parents, they had a young girl who went by the name Crystal, who was supposedly given to them by her biological mother 2 years earlier. Well, that story certainly sounds sketchy as hell, and even though it turns out that Crystal was not Marlena, I wish I was able to learn more follow-up info to find out what actually happened to her. But here's where the confusion lies. It sounds like even though Crystal didn't look much like Marlena, the Childresses were adamant that she was the girl all those eyewitnesses had seen with them in Alabama. Even after the family was found, their former neighbors were shown side-by-side photos of Crystal and Marlena, and they apparently kept picking out Marlena as the girl they saw. And even though the neighbors said she went by Crystal, the social worker who spoke to her claimed the girl told her her name was Marlena. Unlike the witnesses who thought they saw Marlena at the hair salon in Memphis, these witnesses described the girl as having silver-capped teeth, just like Marlena did. So does this mean Marlena was living with the family at some point, but was no longer with them when they were found in Florida? Well, the problem is that everyone remembered the Childresses having 10 children in Alabama, and they still had 10 children months later. So during the time they were on the run, did they somehow manage to get rid of Marlena, pick up another girl, and pass her off as Crystal? I don't know. As weird as this whole situation is, isn't it just much easier to believe that the witnesses' memories were faulty, and the girl known as Crystal was living with the Childresses all along, and Marlena was never there? This lead is certainly an interesting one, but as far as I can tell, there's been virtually no mention of any further developments since the Childresses were found in 1989, so I have the feeling that investigators found no evidence that Marlena was ever with them, and the whole thing turned out to be a dead end. But putting that aside, doesn't it seem like a massive coincidence that Marlena would be abducted by a family who happened to have the exact same last name? It's not like Childress is a common surname like Smith or Jones. Kidnapping a girl who has the same last name as you does not sound like the most practical way to stay off the radar. So now let's finally examine the possibility that Pam Bailey was responsible for her daughter's disappearance. It must be said that other than her confession to Stan Kavnis, there really is no evidence that Pam killed Marlena, which is why the grand jury elected not to indict her. They searched the Obion River pretty thoroughly and never found anything, so if Pam really did dispose of Marlena's body, I have to wonder if she did it at another location. While Kavnis maintained that Pam's confession was genuine and she made the entire thing of her own free will, Pam had been taking a lot of medication and was in a very bad emotional place at that time, so it's not impossible that she could have been coerced, or was just not in her right mind. Though it must be said that while it's not uncommon for law enforcement to coerce a confession out of an innocent person in order to close a case, Stan Kavnis was a private investigator hired by Pam's own family, so it seems odd that he would try and intentionally force a confession out of her, unless he had good reason to believe she was guilty. It appears at least one aspect of Pam's confession turned out to be untrue, and that's her claim that P.L. Summers acted as her accomplice and helped her dispose of Marlena's body. And of course, once she recanted her confession, Pam then changed her story and said that Summers actually abducted Marlena himself because she resisted his sexual advances. Well, it sounds like investigators became satisfied that Summers wasn't involved, either as the abductor or an accomplice, but I do have to wonder if there's some truth to Pam's allegations that he sexually abused her as a child, especially when you consider that Summers was arrested for fondling a 9-year-old boy only a few months later. The guy was over 40 years older than Pam, so he certainly would have been in a position of power when she was a child. It's also interesting that this abuse allegedly took place at the bridge on Camp Brown Road, the same location where Pam claimed she tossed Marlena's body into the river. Now, regardless of whether you believe she killed Marlena or not, the fact that she later attempted to stab her own son makes it pretty clear that Pam is a disturbed person, and I have to wonder if some of her issues may have stemmed from childhood sexual abuse at the hands of Summers. If Pam really did kill Marlena, then perhaps falsely implicating her abuser in the crime was her way of getting revenge. So it's possible that Pam's confession was a mixture of truce and untruce, as she could have caused Marlena's death, but fabricated some of the details she provided. The motive for why Pam would have killed her daughter has always been a big puzzler. Some people thought she seemed like a good mother, while others remembered seeing bruises on Marlena and started wondering if Pam might have abused her, even though I don't believe these allegations were ever proven. The events may have gone down just like Pam said they did, where she simply lost her temper, slapped Marlena, and caused her to fall and hit her head. What's interesting is that after looking through hundreds of articles published in the 2 months following Marlena's disappearance, I never saw any indication that law enforcement considered Pam a suspect, and the impression I get is that her confession seemed to come completely out of left field. When a child goes missing under a parent's watch, they are always the first person police will investigate, but if any of them had suspicions about Pam, they never said so publicly. Even when the man with the red car was tracked down and ruled out as a suspect, I see no indication that investigators started questioning Pam's story. So if she was guilty, it sounds like she did a pretty convincing job at fooling people for a little while. You could probably spend a long time analyzing Pam's psychological makeup and trying to figure out why she did what she did. But before you do that, you also have to look at the timeline of that afternoon's events and figure out how she might have done it. It sounds like the last independent eyewitness who saw Marlena was the owner of the grocery store she went to at around 2 p.m. We know that Mona Watts stopped by the Bailey home to pick up Jerry at 3 o'clock, and while it's not entirely clear if she saw Marlena, Pam would not have been out disposing of her body at this time. She called the police to report Marlena missing at around 4:15, so assuming that Marlena was not killed until after Mona and Jerry left, this gives Pam a window of just over an hour to get rid of her body. It's certainly possible, but the timeline still would be tight. I guess this would lend credence to Pam's story about tossing Marlena's body off a bridge into the river, rather than taking the time to bury it somewhere, which would be a lot more time-consuming. If this is what happened, then Pam is just lucky that Marlena's body never surfaced, and no one found any evidence to implicate her. One overlooked aspect of this story is that Pam was also looking after her 4-month-old son Damon at the time. Assuming that Pam did not just leave Damon alone at the house, she would have had to take her baby with her while getting rid of Marlena's body, which is pretty messed up. If Pam killed Marlena, then I am willing to believe that it wasn't premeditated murder, and may have been a heat-of-the-moment thing like Pam described, where she lost her temper, struck her daughter, and caused her to fall over and hit her head. I mean, that's hardly a defensible situation, but the district attorney did decide to reduce the charge against her from second-degree murder to voluntary manslaughter, so if they had found Marlena's body and convicted Pam, she might have only served a few years, and this whole case would be forgotten by now. On the other hand, when Pam blindfolded her son Casey, drove him to a cemetery, and stabbed him 15 years later, that was clearly a premeditated act. It doesn't look like there's ever been a clearly established motive for that, only Pam's claims that she blacked out and didn't even remember it. But if she was capable of doing that to her own son, then she was certainly capable of doing anything to Marlena. Overall, if this story had ended with Marlena's disappearance, and the only evidence against Pam was her confession, I'd be more inclined to believe she was innocent, but the stabbing incident tells me that she was most likely responsible for what happened to her daughter. Most of the promising leads which seemed to point to a stranger abduction wound up leading to a dead end, and while I wouldn't completely rule out the possibility that Marlena was abducted by someone who has never popped up on the radar, all roads just seemed to lead back to her mother. As far as I can tell, Pam Bailey is still a free woman and has stayed off the radar these past several years, but she definitely seems to be an enigma. Part of me just wants to accept that she's simply a bad person who murdered one of her children and attempted to murder another. But I do get the sense that she probably went through some trauma of her own during her childhood and that she was not in full control of her mental faculties when she perpetuated these horrible acts. This doesn't excuse Pam's actions, of course, but trying to figure her out is definitely one of the most baffling aspects of this story. Since Pam already made one confession about what she did to Marlena, I suppose the best chance we have of this case being solved is for her to feel the need to confess again someday. Only this time, she'll be able to lead people to Marlena's body, or some sort of conclusive evidence which proves she's telling the truth. Because even after 3 decades of all these major twists and turns, there's a 4-year-old girl who is still missing, and even if she's no longer with us, this case deserves full closure. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Marlena Childress, please contact the Obion County Sheriff's Department at 731-885-5832. That's 731-885-5832. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've already released some exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this month, we've got a new bonus episode on the controversial conviction of Michael Scott Martin, which was featured in one of Unsolved Mysteries' earliest final appeal segments. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout out to our latest listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon, and they are Zoe K and Kenda H. Thank you so much for your support. Also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or just leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.